Welcome to All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. According to information from the European Union's Climate Change Service, Earth reached its warmest year on record in 2024. Climate change is resulting in an increased number of floods, wildfires, and hurricanes. It's also increasing their intensity. Last November, the 29th United Nations Climate Change Conference, also known as COP29, was held in Azerbaijan. The goal of the conference is for countries from around the world to work together on ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This conference specifically focused on wealthier countries helping smaller nations with the process. One of the leaders from the Ohio State University delegation at COP29 is our guest today, Bart Elmore, professor of environmental and business history. Welcome back to All Sides, Bart.
Thanks for having me.
So you got to travel with some students to Azerbaijan to attend the COP29. Tell me about your delegation and how it came about. How did you decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take students to Azerbaijan.
Yeah. Well, I guess it happened a year ago or 2 years ago. We've been teaching environmental history classes here at Ohio State for a long time, and we noticed that the students were frustrated. You know, they see that what's happening in the news. They pay attention to the fires in LA and other things, and they want to be involved. They want to do something. So my colleague and I, Nick Breifogel, who's also in the history department, got together. We linked up with the Office of International Affairs, Jeannie Simmons, who's the director there, and Annie Jones, who was along with us on this trip as well. And we said, let's see if we can create a program that takes students to these annual conferences and gives them a chance to have their voices be heard. And this is our second year. We went to Dubai the year before COP28, and this year we were in Azerbaijan. We raised a considerable amount of money because we wanted to make sure that students could go no matter what their means are, from the Mershon Center and the Sustainability Institute, the Center for Slavic, Eastern European, and Eurasian Studies, the Office of International Affairs, Global Education, the History Department, Arts and Humanities, Arts and Sciences, Global Education Fund. I mentioned that because...
So you had money. The students didn't have to, like, sell candy bars to be able to do this.
Exactly. We wanted to make sure they didn't have to sell candy bars. And it meant that we could create a really great cohort of students who were just really motivated, regardless of means, could come with us. And it was just a real joy to watch them on the stage and watch them actually interact and have actual conversations with negotiators and people shaping the future of our world.
Two of the students you went with, you are going to join us in the next segment. How many students did you take?
We took 10, and I think that's about the limit of what you could do. You know, there are other universities that do this. So we've watched WashU in St. Louis, Colorado College, among others. But I think Ohio State has the biggest cohort that goes. So we are... we're well represented, and it's always great because you'll run into a senator or you'll run into somebody that has some kind of Ohio State connection, and there's always a Buckeye photo op that's waiting around the corner.
So even in Azerbaijan, you can say OH and someone's going to answer.
It is, and we were actually out in, I think, you know, ancient petroglyphs, and at some point somebody started an OHIO, and there was a whole crowd of people around us. So
of course they did.
Of course they did. So we had the Ohio love on the in Azerbaijan, and it really was, I think, a monumental COP in so many ways. So much happened there. And I think the students took it all in.
Yeah. I was going to ask you your biggest takeaway, but I can't imagine even picking one. So give it a try. What was your biggest takeaway from this experience?
You know, to be honest, just being there. I mean, I think as a group, we were just so proud of these 10 students. It's a 24-hour trip. So maybe we could have a conversation with Sherrod and Tom about what that
about
was
how
like.
Tired they were. Yeah.
And look, we landed. And I was in the first group that go into the negotiations. My colleague was kind of staying at home base the first day. And we had a two-hour, I think, rest before we went into these things. And they got up, you know, no complaints, dressed, ready to go, after 24 hours of flying. And right there, you know, in those conversations. And this, what was the big takeaway? I think, you know, this was considered the finance COP. Mm-hmm. The idea was, how do we actually create a mechanism through which industrialized countries can channel funds that are needed to countries that are less industrialized to help them adapt to climate change and deal with the effects of this? And the headline that came out of this was that there was a commitment to $300 billion annually being directed from industrialized countries to less industrialized countries to help them adapt and to finance this kind of green a new economy that we need to have to deal with climate change. Nobody was particularly happy about that. That's kind of the way COF works.
Most of the headlines that I saw is that $300 billion a year was controversial. And, most of the smaller countries said it wasn't enough.
Exactly. I mean, when you're there on day one, two, and three, you have Sierra Leone, you have Bolivia, you have Colombia. I was saying, look, trillions, not billions. This is a systemic change of our global economy. $300 billion a year is really nothing. And so I think for countries that are on the front lines of climate change, small island nations especially, who are actually going underwater as we speak, this was a kind of slap in the face. On the other hand, the original commitment going into this COP was $100 billion a year. So,
right, and the United States wanted, I think it was 250. So
exactly.
They wanted more than that lower amount, but less than what was even agreed on.
Exactly. And I think, for the students and for anyone listening, this is COP. It's messy. It's complicated. And I think for students who go in with very pure kind of ideals of this is how this works and everything, they see how complicated it is to have, look, the number of countries that have signed the original agreement that led to these COPs, what's known as the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was originally signed in 1992, It has 190 signatories. So to get any kind of agreement, you have to have unanimous kind of approval for these things. And that's almost impossible. So the fact that something came out of this, even if no one was particularly happy, to me signals that there's progress. And you can build on that as we move forward.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Bart Elmore, Ohio State Professor of Environmental and Business History, and he attended the recent climate change conference with some students. You also wrote a book in 2023, Country Capitalism, How Corporations from the American South Remade Our Economy and Our Planet. And in that book, you address five major American companies that are affecting the environment. Did those companies come up in when you were at the conference?
Yes, and they're there. And one thing I'll say is, for anyone listening in Ohio, we'd love for you to come along with us. We're going to be going to Brazil next year for COP30. And I'll just flag that you might think of climate change negotiations as kind of boring or dull, and there's only just, policymakers there kind of doing these negotiations. But the truth is, the world is there. Business leaders, not just Coca-Cola and, Bayer and these big companies, but also startups and folks who have new technologies and new inventions and new things. So it can be a really exciting space to see folks who are entrepreneurs kind of pitching new ideas and exciting things. That's the optimistic take at COP. What I think we experienced was talking to some of the senior executives that were sustainability executives at some of the biggest companies. They candidly, I think, reflected on our current moment and said that there's this sense that some companies are kind of falling back on their promises. Now, whether that's due to a shift in politics, which maybe we'll talk about later, or something else, it's unclear. But there was a real clear indication that companies had made promises to deal with climate change, but were just not meeting it. One senior vice president, who I'll leave unnamed, from a major corporation, international corporation, said that he's been looking at oil industry's kind of allocation of capital and noticing that it's not going towards kind of new renewables and things like this, but really towards more oil exploration and stock buybacks. And he says, that's where I look in people's balance sheets to see whether it matches, whether they're actually solving these things. And one other thing, Coca-Cola recently announced that it was going back on its promise to reclaim all of its bottles by 2030. That was their promise. They were going to, for every bottle they put out, they would reclaim each and every one.
Meaning recycle a bottle?
Recycle and reclaiming, that sense, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard recycle, reduce, reuse, but reclaim, is this a new R?
I don't think it's a new R. I think it's just me being picky about it, because the truth is, even if you recycle it, it may not get totally reused again. And so,
okay, yeah, be picky about it. I get it. Okay.
Well, even under that commitment, they've gone and said, look, 70% now. Mm. And that, I think, was the pulse at COP. Companies, having made these promises, kind of maybe pulling back a little bit. So that made me a little pessimistic, to be sure, about where are we headed, given what we're seeing in Los Angeles and other places. The severity of this issue is upon us. We need to be moving faster.
Yeah, you mentioned the new administration. The new administration coming in here in the United States is skeptical of climate change and resistant to a green economy efforts. They'll soon be back in office. There were concerns about a turn back in climate incentives even in the Biden administration, too.
Exactly. I think we've been here before. The question was, what did it feel like to be a COP in a way with President Trump coming into office, who has shown, you know, a real kind of antagonism to dealing with this climate change issue. It was the talk of almost every meeting, right, of course. But I think people pointed back to the past. We've been here before. If we look at 2017, when, you know, President Trump had come into office and said he was going to pull out of the Paris Accord, the Bonn meeting, which happened in Germany, in Bonn, Germany, there was still a tremendous representation from the United States. In fact, there was an organization that ultimately formed called America is All In, which is now kind of the face of politicians, business leaders, folks from Coca-Cola, different businesses are saying, even if the administration pulls out, we're going to be here.
The United States will still be there. So in Brazil in 2030, even if the Trump administration doesn't show up, the United States will be there.
Exactly. It's one of the reasons I wanted to chat. It was to say, we're going to be there. And for folks who want to be there, and even if the administration says, hey, we're not headed this direction, that doesn't prevent any of us as civil citizens and folks in civil society to go and be a part of that COP. There is a pavilion. Every country has its own pavilion, which, by the way, is a lot of fun. You get to go to different countries, try their coffee. Germany, for whatever
reason.
It's kind of like Epcot. It can feel a little, like an expo.
Disney World-ish. Okay.
Disney World-ish, which, you know, maybe we can come back to. Some of it, sometimes you wonder, is this how we fix this problem, you know?
Having coffee in France.
Exactly. And these kind of really elaborate pavilions that are all about projecting national power and things like that. But, you know, there's a pavilion now that's called America's All In. And it'll be there, even if the U.S. is pulled out, where people can have a voice, where we can see the work continue. So I'm at least optimistic about that. Even if we don't send our top, folks to negotiate these treaties because the administration doesn't do that, there's going to be a lot of representation in Brazil, and the fight continues.
Well, and I'm sure you saw, it's not just the United States with the Trump administration. There's European countries that are leaning more toward the right, and there's concerns about climate incentives in Europe going back as well. So it's not just America.
Absolutely. I think there's a concern globally about this kind of shift. My take on that is this idea that climate change isn't a right issue. You know, as a historian, we look at this and say that's kind of absurd. You look at 1992, this was passed by a Republican president, George H.W. Bush, who, if you go to the election campaign in 1988, was actually out in front of Michael Dukakis, his Democratic opponent, on issues like climate change. And Republicans were sometimes sponsoring some of the most important environmental legislation at that time. Things changed in the 90s, and I think there was a real shift where this idea that this was going to lead to big government and lead to red tape and so forth and so on made this a political issue in a way that it really shouldn't be. We all care whether we're going to have a house that's not going to burn down on the coast or wherever it might be. We all should care about what this means for our fellow citizens. So I hope that we can get to a point where we don't see this as a right or left issue, whether, here in the United States or internationally.
The $300 billion a year that was agreed upon for wealthier countries to pay to help developing nations deal with climate change. Was there any talk about whether the United States will make their contribution to that if the Trump administration is in?
A big concern.
Yes.
Because the issue is, okay, great. You say you're going to do this. By the way, this is very COP experience, a commitment. But what does that mean? And a lot of conversation about when should we have the target date for meeting this. A lot of people said, let's push it to 2035, so that we can have time to make sure that a new administration that might come in after the Trump administration would be able to commit to this. But as you said, we saw this under the Biden administration. You got a gridlock Congress. You know, it's hard to get almost anything passed. How do you get the funding that you need to make this happen? It's going to become a question moving forward. And I think the bigger issue, too, one that was debated, is should it be private? Should it come from private institutions and banks? Should it come from more public government-to-government grants? There were some countries that said only it only should be government to government. It should be this kind of public funding, not private funding, because they've experienced situations where they get loans, but then they have high interest rates. And is that really progress? So lots to be debated, which is why I think COP30 in Brazil is going to be a big deal next year.
Well, right, because if the United States doesn't pay their fair share, then what's to say that countries in Europe are going to pay their fair share?
Exactly. Right? And there was even there's a big discussion about who's considered a developing country versus a non-developed country that's industrializing. Countries like China and India are often considered Annex II countries, even under the agreement now, which means developing. So they
China's still considered developing.
Exactly. So there's huge debates about that.
Who changes that?
Well, trust me, there was a moment, I remember, we were at a press conference where this was precisely brought up. Would there be any discussion at this particular COP about reassessing who is an Annex I and Annex II country?
Yeah.
And of course, it was a non-starter for the countries that are privileged to kind of be in a position of being seen as an Annex II country, even though everything has changed in the economy. So this is the nature of why this is so complicated. Who should be responsible for this? One person said, well, wait a minute, why are countries and industrialized countries, going to have to raise taxes on working families? And these countries that have a lot of money that are considered Annex II are not having to contribute the same amount. Deep debates and discussions, which is why we left before there was even an agreement. We left the day that was supposed to be all decided, and it carried on into the weekend. They said that, you might have to bring your own toilet paper and stuff like this because the facilities weren't even going to be kept up to get to that final agreement. But we at least got something on the paper, which I think is something, a success. But as I said, a lot of people are still grumbling about the outcome.
Well, let's take a break, and then joining us, we'll have two Ohio State students who attended COP29 with you, and we'll talk more about how it impacts Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. And we're talking about the 29th United Nations Climate Change Conference, also known as COP29, that took place last November. Countries from around the world came together to discuss ways to cut greenhouse gases and battle climate change. Ohio State University sent a delegation to the conference. Still with us is Bart Elmore, professor of environmental and business history. Thanks for being here, Bart.
Great to be with you.
And joining us now is Tom Dunn, a political science and history major here at Ohio State. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, thank you.
And also a part of our conversation, Sherrod Bowens, who is a political science major as well. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for having us.
So from a student perspective, Tom, let's start with you. What was it like to attend this huge international worldly conference and represent Ohio State?
Well, I think there's kind of different aspects to that question. I think first and foremost, as a student for Ohio State, I was extremely honored and privileged to be there. And it was an opportunity I've never gotten to do before, and something I'm never going to forget. As a political science major, I it was really interesting to see sort of how diplomacy works in action and how these sort of conferences unfold and play out. And then as a global citizen, I think it was a little disappointing to see the outcome, but overall, it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, we'll get into the three notions of that. So, Sherrod, what did you think whenever you saw, I don't know if you saw a flyer or an email that said you have an opportunity to attend COP29. What did you think?
Like, yeah.
Sign me up?
It was essentially sign me up, yeah. A few of my friends before had gone on the previous cohort to Dubai in COP28, and I heard about that experience. And it was something I just had to be a part of, especially being from Columbus. And knowing the unique climate challenges that we deal with here in Ohio, representing our communities, my community, on an international stage was just something that I had to say yes to. So I think it was very crucial to just be a part of it and it was a great experience.
And Bart, you obviously, you told me in the first segment you took 10 students, but I'm guessing you had a few more applicants than that.
Oh, yes. We have a lot of applicants. So for students out there, please apply. Well, we love all the applications, but we look for students like Tom and Sherrod who showed us they care, you know, who showed us this isn't just about going on a trip to kind of go to a place and see the sights, but they want to give back. I mean, I think being here, we talked about this, you know, how can we come back and actually talk about some of the things we saw? And so I think the two students you have here are representations of that. They convinced us that they're world changers and they want to do good in the world. So it's a hard application process, but they want out.
So Sherrod, attending the conference, were there certain sessions that you were wanting to attend? Is there a particular thing that you're interested in and you were like, I want to be there, I want to hear that conversation happen?
Yeah, so my primary focus at COP was community violence and also Black and Indigenous people's interactions with climate change. So at COP, you'll find there's something called a press conference, and essentially it is where groups will meet to kind of, it's an elevated stage, and it's about 20 to 30 minutes, and they'll just talk about the issue that they want to speak on. And there were a lot of Indigenous groups that had that space to do so, and I found that very moving as well, since that is one of my areas that I'm interested in, but also given that Indigenous people were given a voice at COP and were prioritized to have their own space and to uplift the direct struggles that they had that were educating all of us, especially living in a developed country.
Tell me something you learned that you didn't know.
Yeah, specifically, I'd say just some of the next year we're going to Brazil. And there were Indigenous groups from Brazil and Indigenous leaders from Brazil talking about the direct challenges that they're facing when it comes to deforestation, when it's coming to exploitation, those kinds of things, to where sitting in Ohio, sitting in America, we're not necessarily thinking about those impacts. But I think it was important to even see how that comes home and how that affects our own Indigenous people here, but also affects everyday Ohioans.
Mm-hmm. Tom, tell me something that you were, whenever you looked at everything that you could attend, you were like, that is something I want to hear about.
Ooh, I think I was really attracted to any kind of energy solutions. I think Ohio is, with a lot of the investments coming to Ohio in tech, I think we need to look at different ways to sort of access energy. And I think a lot of that is going to be just diversification of where we get that energy, solar, wind, and I think in a lot of cases for technology, nuclear. So I kind of... I, for some reason, it felt like the COP was very nuclear-centric in general. But I sort of got funneled off to different nuclear talks and roundtables, and yeah.
Did you learn anything about that that can help Ohio?
Yeah, I think I didn't realize how small nuclear reactors were getting. Right now, they have something called micro nuclear reactors, and I think that is a potential solution for a lot of power draw that we're going to see from a lot of these big technological investments. I think that's those micro nuclear reactors are sort of based on like nuclear subs and nuclear carriers, so this technology already exists, and I think it's a way for sort of these technological investments to fill in the gap where we need to while we expand our green energy grids and stuff like that.
Bart, is that something that Ohio is open to? Because when I think of Ohio's power future, I feel like we're leaning into natural gas right now.
Unfortunately, I mean, I think there's a lot of us who are concerned about that, in the sense that think about this from the COP perspective. In COP28, there was a real commitment in the agreement that said this is the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. That was actually written into that final agreement. I remember in Dubai being like jaw-dropping that it was in there, because you got to remember these were all petro states that we've been at for the last 3 years, whether it be Egypt that hosted 3 years ago, Dubai, which is heavily, you know, most of the revenue coming in is coming from fossil fuel sales, and then Azerbaijan, which I think has like 90% of its export value comes from oil. Mm-hmm. In fact, the presidencies of these two COPs are... The president of these conferences is appointed from within the nation itself. So we had an oil executive, Sultan Al-Jaber in Dubai, who was the head of ADNOC, the major oil company, running COP in Dubai. And then we had the same thing happening here with Babayev, who was the natural resource administrator, but really had worked for SOCAR, who was like the executive at the highest oil company. So you had the oil companies presidents as the leaders of these things. And yet in Dubai, we had this commitment that we have to transition away from fossil fuels and we need to do it on an aggressive pace, which was pretty remarkable given the interests that are there. Some would say, and you can disagree with this, and you know people can have conversations around the table tonight about this, but having oil executives there may mean that we can at least have them at the table and have these hard conversations. If they're not there, maybe there's more antagonism. But others would say this shows the problems with COP, that you know you have such powerful fossil fuel interests driving the conversation that we're not making an aggressive enough transition away from this. So I would say not only here at Ohio State, but at COP29, that was one of the downers, is that people didn't feel like there was enough of an emphasis on what had been said at Dubai, that we have to aggressively transition away from fossil fuels. That language was not in the Baku Agreement at all. Hmm. So back to retrenchment, back to like promises made. You know, it turns out, and I'm a historian, I like to track people when they say, here's my promise. Are they following through on it? I think Ohio State has a lot more to do in this area as well. But the global community, through this agreement, I think also signaled a kind of less than stellar like stance on moving away from fossil fuels.
And Sharad, what do you told me that you are a junior, correct?
I am, yeah.
Okay. So how has this experience influenced you for what you might pursue your senior year? Has it changed what you're thinking about as you head toward the final year in your career?
Yeah. So before going to COP, I potentially want to go to law school, do the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I was also, before I was thinking about diplomacy and kind of going into that and seeing that kind of on a international stage was interesting because there was a question of, is this something that I want to be a part of? But also like, how can I be a change maker within this space if this is a pathway that I take, such as human rights law or something like that? So I think that's the most pressing issue on my mind. But I think that COP also provided such needed clarity on the direction that I want to take both my professional, social, and academic journeys, because I think that it provided a framework of change to, if you figure out how to collaboratively like initiate and engage with the people around you who have like interests, that you can actually move things. And so going into my senior year, I think I'm just focusing on trying to find those places that encourage collaborative growth, specifically around climate justice and what's occurring here in Ohio and on and off campus.
And Tom, what about you? You told me you're a senior. So has attending this changed anything that you were thinking of focusing on as you finish your degree?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily changed what I'm mm-hmm. focusing on, but I think it definitely has sort of clarified what I need to sort of learn more about.
Mm-hmm. Which is?
Just sort of international law around environmentalism and sort of climate protection. I think it's personally in my political science, I'm studying conflict, cooperation and violence. And I think it's pretty obvious that this is environmentalism and changing climate is going to start to play a role in that more and more. So I just sort of being on the ground and getting to talk to people like in person and seeing how these processes happen, I think it was clarifying for me what I need to focus on and where to go for that.
And Bart, you said you took 10 students. I have to imagine that there were 10 different ideas of what they wanted to learn.
Absolutely. We don't pick 10 historians. In fact, we try not to do any 10 of anything. We want them to be engineers. We want them to be poli-sci. Sharad with neuroscience too, you could throw that in as mm-hmm. well. I mean, we look at these applications and it's just like, okay, we could pick whoever we want. This is just mm-hmm. incredible. And we want it to be these students to be somewhat uncomfortable, to be honest with you, to be around each other with like not having their same discipline talking to one another. And when they're there, Sharad said, you know, they make these connections. And I think what he's hinting at is like they were the connector. Ohio State had this WhatsApp chain that was like the COP chain of all the young people. And they were hanging out with these folks and having a fabulous time. They organized a meeting with the State Department and invited over 50 students from across the country, from Yale, WashU, Colorado College, Michigan, They invited students from Michigan. They were allowed in. You didn't bounce them. Sherrod was kind of like the bouncer.
When in November was this conference?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, it was slightly different times in terms of the football schedule. But, you know, I think that is the magic. You know, some people could say, why even take students? And given what I've told you, right? Like, there's problems with COP. I get it. I mean, some people boycott it. But I think what I watch every time we sit back and watch these young people just thrive is the connections. I mean, just meeting all these different people that they now can be, you know, do activism around or you know, link into on a global scale. It's priceless. So anyway, it's always so fun to get to watch them shine.
Climate activist Greta Thunberg and former Vice President Al Gore have been well-known speakers at past COP summits. Were there any speakers or activists that really stuck out to you, Sherrod?
Yeah, there was Andrea Carmen, who is the executive director of the International Indian Coalition, I believe. And she's worked closely within the UNFCCC and with the United States as well to come up with a lot of indigenous rights and like frameworks, which I just thought was very interesting, given that I was able to participate, and myself and a few other students were able to participate in a few roundtables with her and ask questions specifically around a small island nation called Vinnetou.
Where's that?
I believe that it's in the South Pacific.
That's right.
And it was just interesting to see the perspective that she was bringing as well, because I think in the work that she's done for years, it's very grounded in using her voice as an indigenous woman to tell stories of all types of people. And she definitely echoed the importance to contribute with when it comes to loss and damage funding for small island nations who are feeling the biggest brunt of climate change, like Vinnetou. So, yeah.
And Tom, what about you? Are there any big speakers that you thought, I have to hear this, or this is one that really stuck out?
Well, I know Al Gore and John Podesta did speak sometime during the conference. I wasn't able to catch either one, but I was able to sit in on a roundtable with Samuel Asifa, who is the former ambassador from Ethiopia to the United States and currently works as the director of the California Governor's Office of Planning and Research. And it was interesting to see sort of a state representative there rather than like from the national delegation who is there specifically on behalf of California talking about just sort of how they can build greener spaces and more sustainable spaces, especially California right now sort of needs that kind of rethinking. I think that was the most interesting. I got to talk with him.
And Bart, pardon my ignorance, but is most of COP in English?
Yes. So there's the blue zone and the green zone.
You have to tell us what that
yeah, exactly.
is.
Okay. I mean, part of it is, and what I think Tom's getting at with like learning how international law works is learning there's a blue zone and a green zone,
okay.
which, you know, they don't know at first. So there's the blue zone is where the negotiations happen. In that space, traditionally, people are speaking in English. Although you make a really good point, Amy, when there's a moment when there's just like this a need to express, like, let's cut the BS. Let's get to it.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, a person may speak in Spanish from mm-hmm. Colombia, for example. Say, I'm going to speak in my native tongue to emphasize this. And then at that moment, the headphones that we have on right now are at the back of the room. And sometimes it's so swift when this move is happening that everyone rushes to the back to try and get their headphones on to hear the translators who will translate for you. So it feels very much like the UN. You get to hear people sometimes in their own language, although English is traditionally it. That happens in the blue zone. These folks were able to secure blue zone badges, which is hard. You have to be an observer, essentially, to be able to go into the blue zone. So we had to make connections with nonprofits like Second Nature, the Detroit Zoological Society. Thank you, thank you, thank you. The Conference of Mayors in the past has supported us, giving us credentials to be able to be in the room. Oftentimes because they've experienced, seen these students, and say, I want them to be in the room. And the green zone is more like Disneyland.
So the green zone is what we were talking about before, where you, okay, continue. Yeah.
Deloitte, McKinsey, you name the business, they're all there. Mm-hmm. And again, that can be a space in which students are walk away being like, we're totally, what's happening here? Like, are we even debating climate change or are we selling products? But then sometimes in the green zone, they find a technology or somebody who's really committed and say, whoa, this business is incredible. I want to go work for them. Sometimes they get a job offer. So the Green Zone has its ups and downs, I think, but it is more like an expo for people to come in. And I'll flag that for any Ohioans who want to talk to us about this trip. No reason you can't come and be in the Green Zone. You do not have to have Blue Zone credentials to be in that space. And the same people like Al Gore and John Podesta will go to the Green Zone to meet with folks. So it's a great opportunity.
All right. Well, let's hear more about what the Ohio State students thought of the Green Zone versus the Blue Zone after we take a quick break. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. As the planet continues to warm and we have more catastrophic weather events around the globe, a great deal has been expected from climate summits that are held to address these problems. We're talking with members of the Ohio State University delegation who attended the COP29 summit last November. Still with us, Bart Elmore, professor of environmental and business history. Thanks for being here, Bart.
Thank you.
And political science majors, Tom Dunn. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Sherrod Bowens. Thank you for being here, Sherrod.
Thank you.
So before the break, we were talking about a lot of different things, but we talked about the Green Zone. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience in the Green Zone versus the Blue Zone, Sherrod?
Yeah, I did not spend much time in the Green Zone because I was primarily focused on the Blue Zone. But one positive experience that I do know came out of the Green Zone was that there was a social where a lot of my colleagues and the students were able to connect. And so we met activists and students from New Zealand, Australia, Britain, from Slovakia and Slovenia, just different places around the world who had a different outlook on climate change and also how to achieve climate justice. And so I did find the Green Zone to be very productive in that sense to kind of bridge the gap, because the Blue Zone, as beautiful as it is a tad bit chaotic. And so it was kind of nice to just kind of glue us all together in a sense. Trauma bond, if you say, because there was a lot going on. But
trauma bonding, okay.
But I think that we were able to find that in the Green Zone, and I found that very helpful.
Tom, what about you? Blue Zone versus Green Zone experience?
Well, I was in the Green Zone for most of my first week, just because my Blue Zone days were mostly on the second week we were there, so I did spend a little bit more time there. I would say if there's a part of the conference that is quote-unquote greenwashing, I think that would be the biggest candidate for it, but it's a interesting space where people can sort of connect and talk and get together, but there was also a lot of companies there and a lot of business interests. And
did you come home with a lot of tchotchkes?
I did get some interesting some gear, a water bottle, and a t-shirt.
So you mentioned greenwashing. Mm-hmm. So in the summit, it's viewed as greenwashing. It's people saying the right things but not actually putting a climate plan into action. Bart, am I explaining greenwashing?
Yeah,
well,
you nailed it. You see that a lot. It's fun to sit next to a student sometimes who's there for the first time. I actually remember this in Dubai. We listened to this whole speech, and it was like beautifully produced. There was all sorts of video things going on, and the person had like six different wristbands to save the planet and all this kind of stuff. And at the end, I just turned to the student. It was like an hour later. I said, "What just happened? Did he say anything? You know?" And the student quickly picked up on it. He said, "No, it was vacuous. Like there was nothing to that." So I think you see that a little bit in the Green Zone. Folks who are just, it's basically pitches and it's kind of, here's our company and lots of shiny imagery. But the students are really primed after being in the Blue Zone to be like, okay, so like, what is your stance on Article 6.2? You know, like, this is not really, you know, hitting on all cylinders. So I think I feel for the students that are in the Green Zone. And I'm thankful to all the folks who donate badges to these students at Ohio State to go, because Ohio State had not applied for observer status to the UNFCCC as an institution. We have since done that, but we're now in almost year two of waiting to be official observers as an institution to the UNFCCC, at which point we'll have our own badges and we won't have to go to every university that we know and every friend that we know and try and get badges for these students to be in the Blue Zone. Because I think the Green Zone in and of itself would not be as amazing an experience as being able to go into the actual negotiations.
And do other universities have different status? Is it just Ohio State kind of has to catch up?
You have to have somebody that says, hey, let's fill out the application to actually be observers.
And that's you.
That was us in this case, because, well, we learned that, right? And I don't think it's any fault of anybody's. Just hadn't done it. But it requires a letter from the president. And I remember this was right at the time where we were having an administrative change. And so we didn't have it, not whether they wanted to support it or not. We just didn't have a president. So it was like, it was over the summer when we were transitioning. And so we had to kind of figure out how to do it and ultimately got all the documents we needed.
Oh, it took me a second. You needed a letter from the Ohio State University.
That's
president.
Right. Not the president of the United States.
I'm like, wait, when did we not have a president?
Yeah, it was just an interim period.
You needed a letter from Ted Carter, but it was before.
Yeah,
okay.
It was before all these things happened. But, you know, the point is you have to get these official documents together and make it happen. But we're in the queue. The problem now is it's just so many institutions want to be there.
Right.
And so they only have so many spots. So we're just waiting to get the good news.
Sherrod, I wanted to ask you about the protests. All of these conferences come with protests. Did you see that? Did you interact with that? Did that impact you?
Yeah. So at COP, the way that protests function is that there's a set of rules that you have to follow. And for anyone going next year, I would say read the rules before you go, especially given for our situation. It was a bit unique since we were in Azerbaijan and they have actual like laws around protesting and going against the state and certain things like that. But in Brazil, hopefully it'll be a bit of a different situation. But at COP specifically, the way that protests work is that you would have a time slot and then you would go and you would show up and you would say what you want to say. And then everybody would show up, take pictures of you, and then it would be over. It was a tad bit performative because I feel like a protest is supposed to function as something that's spontaneous and you kind of have autonomy around it. But the UN has actual rules that you have to follow. But there was one protest that stuck out in particular, for me specifically, where there was a worker who was working and they spoke to the media and they said, I'm not getting paid and I've been working 8 to 12 hour shifts. And there was an autonomous action that took place because that person was detained by the Azerbaijan police. And so people decided to protest against it. And it was something that was also very dangerous given where we were. But I think that it was a great show of solidarity given that there was a human rights violation that occurred on UN ground and at COP.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, do you have anything you wanted to add about the protests? What was your reaction to them?
I like Sherrod said, they were mostly very contained. They did seem like it was almost like sort of a stage where you come up and say your thing and then you get off and it's very, very controlled. The one protest that I did kind of run into, we were out just exploring a little bit of Baku, and there was an installation of a like sort of a beached dead whale. Like that was a statue built by.
I think I saw pictures of that.
Yeah, we were like, what is that, a whale on the Caspian Sea? And no, it was a statue that a Dutch art collective called Mr. Boomer set up. So that was kind of my interaction with any kind of protest.
But and do you know what that was representing?
It was just sort of representing, I guess, the inaction around the sort of the continuing meeting of COP and kind of the inability to get like major policy passed or
the whales are dying and you're not doing anything about it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Maybe not in the Caspian Sea, but
probably not. But Bart, did you encourage your 10 students to participate in these protests, observe them? What did you want to see out of that?
It's such a good question because there are some universities that are very, you know, very cautious about these things. And we naturally are. We talk a lot about being safe when we're on these trips, and we work a lot with OIA on these things as well, the Office of International Affairs. You know, we went to Dubai. That was the first, you know, this is another country that has very strict rules regarding protests and free speech. And we talked a lot of the students, like, you're not in the U.S. You know, we need to think creatively about this. And to the credit of those students on COP28, they did. They read the rules. They knew what to do. You cannot name a nation, for example. If like Ukraine and Russia are in conflict right now, you can't, you have to, you cannot name drop the nation in your protest, which because of the way that the UN wants to bring everyone together. You can imagine there's a bunch of international conflicts going on and everyone needs to be here to try and solve this problem. So there are, you know, really strict rules. The students read them. I've always been very impressed with them in the sense that they follow the rules and make sure not to get in trouble. But one of our students was actually on the big screen at COP29, having done a protest in COP28. Her protest was so effective that she ended up on the massive screen in front of the United Nations from her protest from a year ago. Hmm. So our students are having an impact. I would just say that. Last thing I'll say on that, though, is as much as I love watching these young people thrive, it's not on their shoulders to solve this problem. You know, I had an opportunity to talk to Jane Fonda once about climate change issues, and I said something like,
"Oh, that's a sentence no one's ever said before."
Well, okay. She came to Ohio State, and the student said, "Hey, would you like to talk to her and moderate the conversation?" I said, "Of course." And she said, I said something. I started off thinking it was going to be an easy one. I said, these young people give me such optimism. She said, "Don't put that hurt on them. Hmm. This is not just their fight. This is our fight. There are adults in this room who need to be doing their job. It's not just young people." I never say that anymore. I never say the young people, you know, they're going to fix it because of that statement. So as much as I loved watching them, I hope they feel like I'm a partner with them there, that we're all in this together, fighting to try and figure out how we can solve this problem.
I like knowing that Jane Fonda changed you. So I wanted to take some time to talk about green jobs. Sherrod, you can you talk a little bit about some, you know, careers or jobs that you discovered that maybe you didn't know were a possibility for the future?
Yes. Specifically in the context of Columbus, I think that there's not necessarily pinpointed jobs that have been created yet, but I think there's a large potential for them to exists. For example, this COP was the finance COP. Mm-hmm. So it was focused on how do you get money pushed out? How do you phase? How do you get loss and damage funding? All of those kinds of things. And the connection that I kind of made with that is that Columbus, we have our own climate action plan. So it's kind of as we're navigating this international scale, like climate change on an international scale, how do we bring that home to Columbus and fit that in and guide our own climate action plan? And I think that a large thing that can come out of that is the creation of green jobs and also like equitable urban planning that occurs as well, which will also allow for people to exist in better spaces that are more climate renewable or that are more climate sustainable, which helps them, I believe, just to kind of focus to have better outcomes when it comes to actually existing in Columbus and being in Ohio. I feel like another focus is that there's a large accountability crisis that I feel like we have with climate change at times, which can really also kind of pertain to Columbus as well, as to what is happening, who's causing the issue, and how do we help the communities that are most affected. And I think that that can come through providing jobs and also come through providing climate reparations in a sense.
Do you think that maybe you're going to try to ask for a meeting with the mayor? You would say, I have a few ideas here.
I think that that's very realistic and something that I would be interested in. I think it's just a matter of how do, as a community member, I provide those solutions as well for my immediate community to where then it can be provided on a large scale for all of Ohio.
And Tom, I mean, I didn't ask if you're from Columbus or from Ohio, but can you expand on what Sherrod was just saying on how those green jobs could impact Ohio as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Cincinnati, so okay. I moved up here. But I think I think, like Sherrod was saying, it's kind of sort of about a ground up rather than top down approach to climate action. It's sort of what can we do here and now, what's possible for us. And I think green jobs are in a lot of ways can support that from the ground up and make it sort of more expansive, I guess, for the community to get involved. Like, oh, I have a job or career in solar panels or nuclear technology or whatever. I think that is important in sort of doing that, grassroots sort of change of our energy grid.
Okay, and Bart, we're down to less than a minute to go, but you're planning to take the next group. You have to start those plans to get them to Brazil. But this group, can you encourage them to do things like meet with Ohio lawmakers, meet with the mayor,
yes,
to keep this going?
We, in fact, met with the mayor in Dubai, and we met with most of the team during the course, the 15-week course that we had. Mm-hmm. the mayor's office, really, to talk about all sorts of ways we can give back. And so we will be kind of reconnecting with them to try and do that. And, you know, we also have a host of different internship opportunities. And I would just encourage anybody who's interested in any of this to reach out to us. We want this to be an opportunity where we take Ohio, as many Ohioans as we can, to Brazil with us. So, and that can be in a capacity of just supporting us or, you know, connecting via Zoom or whatever it is. But we're here to be a part of, we're all in, even if an administration says that we're not. So hopefully we can go together.
You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you to Bart Elmore, professor of environmental and business history. Thank you, Bart.
Thank you.
And also thank you to political science major Tom Dunn. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
And also Sherrod Bowens. Thank you, Sherrod.
Thank you for having us.
And listeners, thank you for joining us. This is 89.7 NPR News.